Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about neutrons, protons and electrons. Basically, I'm going to give a podcast on what I understand so far of nuclear physics. Now, what's sort of happened is I've had a classical education, which I think most of you would have had, where you were introduced to neutrons, protons and electrons, and then maybe if you did a physics course, you've been introduced to mesons and pions and, you know, various things like that, a bit of nuclear physics. I've sort of been rather a classical upbringing in terms of that. These just really, really small balls, you know, like if you can imagine a ball bearing, they're incredibly small. So now for various sort of like inroads, if you can imagine a sort of a dark field and a light being shone across, and you walk across there and you explore a bit of a city and you begin to come away with a sort of a knowledge of it and come back and say, this is not quite what I imagined. So the first link into it is in quantum physics, where basically you got to use the wave function in a very sort of down-to-earth basic way, sort of calculating atomic molecular spectra with it. And as you worked on it, more and more you had to say, well, look, I'm going to have to abandon what I've been taught at school, that the electron's a tiny dot. And essentially that there's a model called the Copenhagen model, where the electrons come into existence and out of existence over a space defined by the wave function. And, besides having no... sorry, I'm stopping this all the time because I'm being bitten alive by these mosquitoes. It's a sort of a natural thing. Australia's had a huge amount of rain, huge amount of water about the place, a huge number of mosquitoes. Now look, that aside here. So essentially, a little bit while realizing, look, in this sort of very polite world where everyone is right and ignorant people aren't really ignorant, they're just not educated yet, and anyone who's studied it for a while can have any idea they want and stand up, and the more articulate they are, the better they are at it. So you have these people talking about wave particle duality. That is really a way of shut up, I really don't understand it, and it's a mystery. And sort of like they declared it a mystery a bit too early, as far as I can see. Other group of people talking about the electrons aren't really wave functions, they're the wave function's an envelope, and they exist as what I thought in the first place. It's sort of like sort of saying, I don't believe in Santa Claus, but no, the president's got there. That's because Santa Claus has got mind control over people, forcing people to do Christmas. It's so you explain it by you keep your theory anyway, even though there's massive evidence against it. So eventually I came in, and fortunately I had some computer. I don't know how anyone can really understand wave functions unless you actually compute them on a computer at some level. And you sort of go into the history of these things, and you read these critical junctures. What is it? The Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which sort of divides out wave functions. So there's points of time where there's this complicated wave equation, and people come in and say, well, for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to just only take half of that and divide it. There's a good ways that you can cut the wave function. So the first cut is the time and time independent waveforms, and indeed that's a very, very good way of cutting it. So time dependent and time independent. So obviously if you have a picture in a textbook, that's a time independent one, because it's you shut the textbook, open it up, it's still there, it's always there. And then the time-dependent one, you tend to be in a different chapter and they'd give you different problems, but they're all interrelated and they haven't actually divided. So your wave function, this is a fundamentally all this is quantum physics. It's just with more quantum numbers, as you know, to get more complexity, and I'll get into the quantum equations there. So essentially you can get this basic understanding, and it's one of these horrible things. You might be given the gift of, I don't know, call it a gift, a lack of disability, like in mathematics and computation, and eventually you go across it. And there's this sort of threshold where you say, I don't understand that, but that's obviously the answer, and eventually I will understand it, or I'll come to some sort of greater understanding. It's sort of, when people are sort of confronted with new information, there's this sort of thing where they, you get these two things that the sort of, I suppose, aggressive people moving up don't clean their whiteboard of information, of their preconceptions. They sort of say, oh, this is a new piece of information. Oh, right, well, I'm going to be so aggressive, I'm going to hold on to my old ideas, and here's this new idea on the same whiteboard, and gosh, I can't think anymore. Whereas the more humble of us who get kicked around a bit, say, this new idea, looks as though, just wiping out this area of the blackboard. So I've sort of had to do that a little bit with classical physics, but still, there's this sort of area of classical physics that you realise that the human race has really understood really well and don't understand as well anymore, and you read into it and you find out that these beautiful ideas which sort of had their heyday in 1880 or 1900, these beautiful, really accessible ideas which weren't as good, we've put it aside, and of course it's sort of like kicking away the scaffolding. It means that the rest of us human race come up and we haven't rebuilt a scaffolding forward. I'm thinking of complex numbers, complex planes, the very general basic science which we thought of our way through. And I will get to some juicy points here. So you've got the Schrodinger wave equation, and there's really two cuts on it. Two sort of cuts. There's the time dependent, which is deals with the energy and the phase of it, and the time independent, which is the spatial stuff. And really, the two are not, or they're not connected for stationary things. They're incredibly connected for a particle which has to move. You know, its wave function has to move across in space. It's a free particle. It's okay. But for a stationary particle, you can easily put the two separate. To go across there, then there's, I suppose, the set of ideas where you give them a set of basis set of wave functions, and which is the S, P, D, and F. And the reason that we take those wave functions is more anthropological, whatever, anthropomorphic. That is that. They're the ones that humans can understand quite easily, but of course nature takes, if you can imagine a beautiful grid coordinate space which is nice and easy to count, nature's often a little bit skew, takes a little fraction of other things and combines things in and takes the symmetry a bit differently, and you can adjust the focus of your lens by doing transformations, and in generally, if you can unitize the matrix, i.e. that's human comprehensible, but actual nature itself have these off-axis things. Thanks, Spa. Did you take... Oh, it's good that you took your bag. I didn't think you took it. Thanks a lot for that, Sebastian. This is COVID-19 world in which having a heart operation, I'm no longer allowed, even though I'm really good, no longer allowed outside the premises. And my son, who's a bit better, but he goes off and gets the supplies, but no cash, and definitely washing your hands before and after and stuff like that. So just on the COVID-19 stuff, Australia might be, I don't know, it sort of reminds me of when I was setting up a really bad experiment, really hoping that I'd be able to see something amongst the noise to pick it up, which is not a bad thing. I've often done that with experiments. These, what people think is hopelessly tuned laser or something like that, being able to just pick up a bit of just a slight change in the colour. There is this, like the eye is, I think, remarkably well-tuned machine to actually pick up spontaneous emission versus stimulated emission. There's something eerie about it, a stimulated emission, you pick it up. So similar here, I'm looking at the COVID data and looking at the various countries and going, oh, maybe, hopefully, this will kick in here to various things. But getting back to it, so you've got the wave functions out there, and the sort of the knowledge that there's this incredibly complex zoo of particles to understand, and electrons and protons and neutrons to understand, and you know that the textbook phenomenological understanding, saying it's got such a weight, such a lifetime, seen here, discovered by whom, really doesn't really get you into it. So this is what I hope to explain a bit. And I think people are, maybe people are in the same boat as me, but there's a lot of filler information about these particles, all very relevant if you're using them and stuff like that, but not very much to get really deeply into things. And various points as you study astrophysics and other areas of physics, you realize that you can only perceive certain things. You can only perceive three dimensions yet, and that's legitimate. And you can only perceive time now. The human race has now got an idea of past and future. Animals, I don't think, have very much of a sense of past and future. They've got sort of very much here and now, very much contentment going through. So you've got this stuff along here. And as you go into a particle and really understand it, you realise, oh my God, I just need to explain this atom, I need two identical universes superimposed on top of each other, spin up, spin down, and that is somehow the geometry of the universe has changed such that I have translation in it, linear translation, x, y, z, which is my space filling stuff, and rotational stuff. But rotational stuff is very much different from the other ones. Like I can take a lab anywhere in the world and throw something across, and the laws of physics will operate with it equally for all sorts of labs, whether it's on a cruise ship or some other things which goes across. Reminds me, it's very difficult to, if you give a precise explanation of a non-accelerating frame of reference for this type of stuff, and you give it correctly, and the kids try and reproduce it in exams, the correct version, and you've got an ignorant teacher at the other end marking the whole thing, it's like this mincer. I don't know, you've got a precision machine, and it gets minced up at various points of time. So the Yeah, like all points of the surface of the Earth have an acceleration frame, blah, 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 and stuff like that. So, for all common acceleration, what exactly, I suppose what I should get down to is focus on the rotational frame of reference. You can tell 100% how fast something is rotating with respect to you by looking at a YouTube video of it, no matter how far away it is. The rotation, the universe is frozen out in rotation space. So the entire universe, at the farthest point or the nearest point, has the same rotational framework. I can get two objects and at different parts of the universe, and I can stop them. I can get one rotation, and with respect to the other one can stop rotating. And means, of course, you've got to start to have to get this collapse. You've got to have hidden dimensions, or phenomenologically, you get spin up, spin down. And trying to understand this, you've got to be very careful building your different models. There's Posty coming past, so you've got to get yourself a different a model. And there's sort of that aspect, and also the holographic pixel size of models. You know, eventually when you come down to the fundamental pixel of existence, which is a fundamental particle, like an electron, it ceases to have smaller bits. It is fundamental. It has no smaller bits. Having smaller bits, then if it has a property, it has no explanation with regards to a smaller bit explanation scheme. So we have to, essentially, you have to swap over in explanation schemes from them. So if I have a coin and it's spinning around, it's got smaller bits to it, and therefore I can explain it in terms of those smaller bits. But the electron is a definition of the smaller bit, so it itself can't spin, and it has a symmetry. Now, one of the things that took me a while to pick out is that a lot of people are taught symmetry by actually having a triangle, and you put a little mark on it, and then you rotate it around and you show it. It's the same, it's moved to get across, but really, by putting a mark on it, you've broken the symmetry, and so it can actually move, and it's moved in the same circle. So people get a complex idea that I can move it, but I can't know about it, but it actually does, it will move in real life, whereas an electron, these basic particles, you can never mark it, you can never move it around, and you can never sense that it's moved around, and it fundamentally has these symmetries. It is unteachable. It is unteachable in a way that it doesn't have the property of that symmetry. I don't know if I've said that correct. So the electron has an SU2 special unitary group symmetry. SU, I think, is special unitary way. SU2 in brackets, and you've got different ways as people go across, they have to summon up more and more of these symmetry numbers to describe what they can do. But the definition is that they're not describing the symmetry. That is the symmetry with which it exists in our universe, and having that symmetry therefore says something about our universe. This is the consensus. So an electron, you cannot rotate an electron because it's got no, it is too small to have sort of the fundamental thing of a rotation. If you really go into it, is if you look at the fine print, that cup which I'm rotating has smaller parts, therefore I can see it's rotated, and so it so I can secretly rotate it around. It may look identical, but I can put a little mark on it. I can rotate it and see. So it look. It's not a magic trick. Well, it is. What can I say? Magic trick, not magic trick. I'm just trying to get down on these fundamental particles. So an electron cannot rotate, and it physically doesn't rotate yet. It does have the property of a mass rotating. It has the property. It has the property as if by magic. So an electron can have an arbitrary large or small size. It can have so if I have a ultra cold electron in space, I suppose you could bind it in space, sort of very large. There is an electron concept which could be as big as a light year across, and this is a bit complex to understand once you've got the fundamental pixel size of space. Space there. The space is another thing which has definite properties. There's a difference between a box drawn on a space on a blackboard. You could draw two boxes. One box is empty space, as in conceptually Euclidean empty space. And the other box, inside the thing, you could say, oh, this piece of space, I'm going to do some measurements on it, and in that speed of space, that space, I have light waves which it can hold electromagnetic radiation, it can do all these things, particles can pop in and out of existence in it. So you've got your two, on your left hand side, you've got really conceptually empty space, and you've got the actual, you know, real space, that our real universe which we exist in. People sort of don't make that point. When they're teaching kids, they say, oh, look, kids, there's empty space, nothing, you know, yet. Now, scientists now do believe that it's not empty. Well, I don't know, that's a sort of crazy way of doing it. Now, it's important that that's really the other aspect of it, is that your electron wave function, besides having spin up, spin down symmetry, is existent in this fully described space. So just going in on an electron, the fact that an electron doesn't have any parts and cannot actually physically rotate means that from its formation it has twice the magnetic field for its rotational oomph. So it's got an inertia. In fact, the idea that light has a certain amount of rotational push, so light has one or minus one spin angular or angular momentum pushing through. So a light has a Planck energy of angular momentum. So in essence, if you were to fire polarized light from a laser beam in deep space, it would put out, that laser beam will begin to spin around because it's angular momentum going out of a star. It's equally polarized, but if you're able to do it, you'd be able to spin up that laser beam. It would begin to rotate more and more, and if that light was absorbed by something else, it would spin the opposite way. So space itself can bring this angular momentum in it. So there's these properties of it. So you need your particle and space together, and the particle and its existence in space is very much what it is. So you can have this particle free in space, your fringe magnet free in space, and its gyromagnetic ratio, that is the amount of gyro ratio for magnetism produced, is a factor of 2, an electron. So the electron that you would draw with the current teaching level would be a factor of 2 less magnetic than the actual electrons, given from what we can measure. We can measure the actual rotation speed of the current inside the electron. So the current electron has a rotating current inside of it. It's got a magnetic field, it's got a rotating current. That's the end of the story. It's just that the rotation doesn't occur in our perceivable universe. It's perceived, it's because of our folded universe. We've got two universes on top of each other. We can't say it's rotating in a hidden dimension. So an electron itself, it's got a spin, it's got rotating charge in it. That charge goes on an area. It's got a dipole moment. That is a current. A dipole moment is I times the area of it. So 1 amp over a square meter has a dipole moment of 1 unit. I don't know what you'd put it there. You've got the Bohr magneton. Bohr magneton is basically he calculated the current, the orbital rate, the orbital period, and the radius coming out to work out the various angular momentums. And it's physically got a space, and it's physically got a current, but it hasn't got any parts, so therefore it doesn't have a space and it doesn't have a current. It doesn't have parts and space in what we can see. It's of a higher mathematical symmetry to go through like that. So that's very interesting, and yeah, I really want to see myself, is there any way that I can imagine a topologically knotted space in my 3 dimensions, which could be, I could somehow imagine into the 4 dimensions that actually pull through. So the sort of the closest I can get to in my imagination is a sock being pulled in and out, rather than a sock being pulled in and out has the correct symmetry compared to a gyroscope. Or a gyroscope is obviously, if I applied charge and put it on the rim of my gyroscope, you know, if I had a perspex gyroscope and I put charge on the outside of that and I span it, I would create a magnetic field. And so on the bigger point, a moving magnetic field is a moving electric field is a magnetic field in this space. So there's 2 aspects to understanding, a sort of a deeper understanding of what space is, deeper understanding what electrons are. And so coming across there, you start to understand things and start to basically learn the grammar of matter. I think the grammar of matter might be the better way to describe it. So there are, in terms of the spin symmetry of things, and this is intensely eerie, there are 2 groups of systems. There's systems with a spin a half, that is that if you reflect it through the origin, if you're able to take it through the origin, it's negative of itself. And this is a mathematical thing, but this mathematical thing means that it can't exist in the same universe. That so there are two, in terms of the word spin. And spin does refer to rotation, but it doesn't refer to rotation as you and I said. It refers to the rotational collapse of the universe. There's fermions and bosons. So fermions are electrons. Electrons, hadrons, I suppose it would be your general things, or the things that which are fermions. The fermions are leptons, baryons. So under electrons are let's go. Bosons have spin 0 or 1, integer spin, and they can exist on top of each other in space. They can actually sit through each other in space, and we're quite used to it. We have sound and light are bosons, and that they go through space, and we can get as much light as we want to on a stage. So if I have a spotlight, the light goes through each other and out the other end. It doesn't bounce off each other. You don't get light bouncing off each other. So you've got the bosons, and then on the other side you have fermions. These are things with spin 1/2, and they're the fermions. You can have leptons. Which are the electrons and neutrinos, and then you can have the baryons. The baryons are made up of quarks, and they have an odd number of quarks in them. So they're not really fundamental particles. They're composite particles, but they're so common that we call them a fundamental particles. We don't call an atom an atom can be a fermion or a boson depending on its constituents. A quark, a bunch of quarks can be a fermion or a boson, depending on the amount of spin fermions in it. So you've got leptons, which is electrons and neutrinos, and then you have quarks, which are also fermions. But the quarks, if there's an odd number of quarks in it, that is an odd number of quarks is a baryon. An even number of quarks turns out to be something called a meson. So meson means intermediate, a baryon means heavy, and it's a little bit complicated. So you've got the word hadron. Hadron comes from the Greek, means thick. So this has got some sort of thickness to it. This is sort of mass to it. And so hadrons are made of quarks. An even number of quarks is a meson. Okay. And, an odd number of quarks is a baryon. Okay. The quarks have feel something called the strong force, which is a force which is mediated by gluons. Well, you could say it's gluons, but it's a very strong, very powerful, close range force for these things called quarks. And the quarks have a quantum number which they've assigned to it. It took a while to assign it, and that is the quantum chromodynamics, QCD. It means we use, instead of to get people used to a symmetry group which everyone can use without having to use maths is we use colours. And there's six colours. Red, I suppose it would be, I think it's red, green, blue for some reason. It's odd. Not red, yellow, red, yellow, blue. These are it is red, green, blue for some reason. That's incredible. Red, green, blue. They're the three colours, and they're equivalent to what we would call a charge in terms of electric charge. But that's if you imagine those three, you know, we have positive and negative charges. For electrons, these are the charge. So they have nucleons, which the word nucleon, and a lot of this is historically based as people are working out. And what the overall problem is that teachers go back and read a history of what this last person thought before they were proven wrong, and then a different thing was evolved, which I couldn't quite understand. They will tend to teach the last thing out. So we have the word nucleon, which is basically in a time where they thought that the neutron and the proton were the same species, but the neutron was an excited state of the proton, which is so you can actually have a proton in an excited state. That a proton in an excited state is a delta particle. That is, it's got two ups and down quarks in it, except it can be an excited state. So you can actually have a proton and put energy into it, and it can go into these excited states. I think it's called a delta stuff. So you've got this is sort of like a train wreck of ideas where people have decided at each point not to cut from the last point of thing, carry on a few ideas. So nucleon's a bit of an outdated word. They really had to get a definition between hadron and baryon. So baryon refers to nucleons, but it also refers to a whole lot of anything with three quarks. Hadron refers to anything with quarks. Quarks are these little units which react to the strong force. Now the a quark is the quark component, the intrinsic mass of a quark, in terms of its contribution to the mass, is around 10% of the mass of a neutron or a proton. The rest is orbital energy going inside it. If we can just pull back to the electron. Electron is one of the things I wanted to point out is an electron, as we observe it, because an electron, I don't know whether an electron can exist outside our universe, but an electron in our universe has a factor of two. It is spinning, but it produces double the magnetic field for its spin. It's whatever it is, whatever the spin is, it's the magnetic field is a factor of two because it's actually spinning twice as fast, or twice as far. It's the same. But it also has a anomalous gyroscope factor. It's a point something or other, 0.023% increase, because that's got a as it's going through, it's generating a sea of positrons and electrons around it, and a positron and electron has got a huge moment, and so producing that for a fraction of a second, it changes into something else. It then couples more, and you get this extra factor. So your fridge magnet is sticking onto your fridge by 202% stronger than it should be, and that 2% is so that 2 is from the fact that it's the electrons in it are rotating outside the inner dimension that we can't comprehend, and another one is you've got that 1%. 1%, or I suppose, 1% factor of it going in this froth of particles going across. Now, in neutrons and protons, this is 90% of the mass of this. Is it moving about the place, producing it? Now, one of the things that people said, "Hang on." This can't be a neutron and a proton cannot be a fundamental particle. It's being fundamental, we can say, oh, I can still explain part of it due to its components. It's not fundamental. Is that its magnetic moment was all stuffed up? That is that a neutron, which has effectively no charge, does have a magnetic moment. So it's actually made, we know it's made of components which have stuff. I think they've got very small magnetic moments, significant for a NOR scan. But the neutron has got a slightly reduced magnetic moment, pointing the opposite direction. I.e. that was a proton obviously has positive charges moving around. A neutron, if you had to describe it classically, has a positive charge with a negative shell on the outside. So when you spin it, the negative charge is going faster. So that's undeniably true, that must be true from that set of models, but the actually how it actually comes up to that is far more complicated, because the actual a neutron is a up and two down quarks, an up being plus 2/3 and the down quarks being minus 1/3, so the overall charge goes there. But then you've also got gluons, and it takes an absolute supercomputer to calculate these things out, which basically tells you that human imagination has to approach this at a different rate. So you have this colour charge. It is red, green, and blue. For some reason, I wonder what that is. It may be the colours of a TV. Oh, yes, the colours of TV. If you compose red, green, and blue light, you produce white light. And then they introduce something which is not physical, of course. You can produce white by red and anti-red light. So you can have anti-red. You can have the anti-particle. And this is important. Because one of the things that they found out that the neutrons and protons were not obeying Fermi exclusion, the Pauli exclusion principle. That is that you can't have two things with the same the components of the neutron and proton have the same. Don't obey the Fermi exclusion principle. If you didn't have more, not Fermi, Pauli exclusion, if you didn't have more components in it to explain what's going on. So the die was set that they had to come up with more quantum numbers, and of course they came up with more and more and more quantum numbers. Everything, every turn, they came up with more quantum numbers. So I'm starting to list some of the quantum numbers for your nucleons. Now, the important thing to realise is that once a neutron is made, and it's got a set of, and it's in its ground state, it's got a full set of quantum numbers. It has to actually have it's got to then have its actual spatial wave function different. So let's try and get this right. So if I've got two neutrons in an atom, that, say a helium, I've got two neutrons in it, or say a helium's got two protons and two neutrons, the proton and the neutron can actually exist through each other in space because they have different quantum numbers. Well, you know, this is colour quantum numbers, so that they can exist through each other in space. The two neutrons can have different quantum numbers because they can have spin up, spin down. So I can have all four helium nucleons, using the old term. They're baryons, they're hadrons, but they're not mesons. So you can have hadrons and mesons. These two things. So you do only have a problem when you get up to the next, say, helium 5, which is important because that's what's made in tokamak nuclear reactors. You make that, you get a deuterium and tritium together. That next neutron is has to be in a spatially excited space. So that neutron is like a P-shell electron. It's got a P-shell shape, but it exists right through the nucleus. And, of course, this has got a high energy, and you can calculate it, and that's the energy given out in the fusion reaction. The two go together, a little bit of energy to go together, but it's a resonant making a deuterium and tritium together, and then that will explode with a neutron in its ground state. So the neutron goes from the P spatial state to the bottom of space. So in your nucleus, all the particles are at energy levels and have identical spatial wave functions, which gives you different symmetries. So they have orbital angular momentum. They've got the whole rock show of atoms repeats again down in the nucleus, and you have gamma ray spectra. So, say cobalt 60 star has got its nucleon up in geometrically contorted space, and it is symmetry forbidden to go down to its ground state. So it can only do a two photon emission. It produces two identical photons. You cannot even imagine, or can't even get anywhere close, if you have Bohr's stupid models of the little nucleons as separate little spheres. How could it go to a lower energy state if it's bizarre. If you look at the symmetry, the old Bohr liquid drop model from 1936, it just simply, the problem is it's incredibly complex, because the way that you can rearrange nucleons in a bag goes up is just bizarre. So if you can imagine, a Rubik's cube, you've got those Rubik's cubes of symmetry that you could have a nucleus. So basically, if you look at Bohr's liquid drop nucleus, is you may as well look at it as a Rubik's cube. It's got just so many different symmetries it could have, whereas the actual nucleus is the Sachsen-Briggs way of looking at it. These are not new things. I think Sachsen-Briggs is from the 50s or 60s or something like that. Briggs, Sachsen-Briggs. Now, the entire thing is that if you have studied quantum physics and you just walk into it, it would not occur to you to think any differently. Like you think, oh, it's like this, and then you look at the emission spectra. So a nucleus can have all these excited layers. They can have forbidden layers. So like cobalt-60, the reason that cobalt-60 is used is because nuclear energy is stored in the nucleus at a forbidden layer, and so that's why it's got such a long lifetime. There are other things where it's got a long lifetime because it's low energy. It's in general, something is radioactive for a long time because it has gone down through all these paths and it's got a forbidden transition, or the transition is unusual one. I think so. Most things get over and done within a millisecond. It's just these other bastards can take a long, long time for it. And it's it's generally a neutron or a proton which changes physical shape. And so a neutron in a atom can have shells. Spherical shells. The other reason is, there's a whole series of things, and of course the electrons and the neutrons and protons are completely transparent to each other, so they overlap each other. So the electron has a presence inside the neutron going through, and we can measure shifts in it. So if I have an atom, and I add more neutrons in the inside, there's a small shift due to the electron interacting with the quark charge on the inside. So getting on, you've got this historical background, and so the first historical thing is people saying that we will introduce a new quantum number, and we'll call it spin because it's got the same symmetries as spin. So a lot of the times when they talk about a symmetry and the SU6 symmetry, you go, oh, how does that particle physically have an SU6 symmetry? They're talking about the symmetry of the equation. So when they came up with in 38 or something like that, the term isospin. So isospin is something not for electrons. So a nucleus will have a neutron and proton will have an angular momentum spin of a fermion, but we'll also have another thing called isospin. And isospin is simply a quantum number for the number of up quarks minus down quarks. So a proton will have an isospin of a half because it's got two ups and one down. A neutron will have an isospin of minus a half. Now, we can actually make another particle which has got an isospin of 1.5, and that's three ups, and so it's a delta 2+, and that has an isospin of 2/3, and the actual length of that vector. So that's a very much a historical thing because they rather than having a separate quantum number for up and down, they couldn't work that out. They didn't know what up and down was. So they had this sort of slightly odd quantum number called isospin, which is the up-down quantum number. Now, so you've got your particles along there. Now, the interesting thing is that you can have a a meson. So your hadron, your hadrons have got three, mesons have got two. Mesons have got two, and essentially they can have two ups or two downs, or an up or a down. Or there's actually takes a little bit remembering to get across him. So it can have two up and a down. So it can have whatever it wants inside. It's got an up and an anti-up. It's got to have an anti-up because of the colour. It's got to have red and anti-red. Red and anti-red equal white. So you can have red, green, blue, and that equals white, or red and anti-red, or green and anti-green, or blue and anti-blue. But anti-blue means it's got to be an anti-particle, reverse particle. So mesons can have are bosons, and they can have an isospin of one, that is an up, an anti-down. Well, they can have minus one, which is a down and an anti-up. So that's, and we call mesons pi particles. And so you can have pi mesons produced. Now, how they actually saw all of this is that very early in the 40s, they didn't have accelerators or anything like that. They took the cloud chambers up on top of a mountain, high mountains, and the cosmic rays would stream through, and they go, oh my shit, there's so much happening up here. And they would see these tracks. And in the magnetic fields, these are contrails of tracks, and they'd be able to see the particles. So if a particle streamed from outer space and caused a shower of particles to rain down, they could do the following things. They could keep an area, a chamber, and what they would do is they would suddenly increase the pressure in the chamber, and at that point in time, clouds would instantly begin to form, and they would form on the charged trail. Now, what would happen is that these particles would cause the gas around them to ionize, and this ionized stuff would the vapor would condense, and so you'd have these contrail clouds which would map these things out, and you could, by various means, work out, it was like a big billiards table, you could work out the mass and thickness and the various things of these clouds. And this is sort of a bit of a lost art. People began to actually really look at these clouds and look at, you know, what sort of particle it was, what sort of mass it is by the width and thickness of the clouds and the curviness of the clouds. And they found that there was a whole heap of these exotic particles, which, a whole zoo of particles, which had roughly the mass of the neutron and the proton. There were ones which had intermediate, much lighter mass. So they were around two-thirds of the mass, which, i.e. that they were made up by only two quarks. But these lasted only a very short time, and these were called the mesons. The mesons have an isospin of 0 or 1, or minus 1. And what is it? Barons have the baryons, B-A-R-Y-O-N, baryons have the isospin of a half or minus a half, or in more exotic cases, you can have plus two-thirds or minus two-thirds. Now, you've got isospin as one direction, and so isospin's a more historic thing. I don't know whether they would... It's sort of a very convenient one. Then we have... Oh, my God, what the fuck? So I just saw this bird carrying this huge branch down from the tree opposite. Sorry, guys. So you've got isospin. So isospin we'll put on the x-axis, and we have the first accessible particle called the strange particle. So we've got all up that we have discovered is six quarks. And six quarks are up, down, strange and charm, top and bottom. And once you go to charm, that's sort of like a nightmare of a particle. A charm takes quite a lot of energy to produce, and then when you get more and more powerful accelerators, you get top and bottom. And by looking at the symmetries of these things, which relate fundamentally to the symmetry of how you can fold these particles into space, and the symmetry of space and the symmetry of the strong force of space itself, yeah, called the standard model. Such a model which is so powerful that it's sort of like quantum mechanics without the actual deep logic in it. So you've got the standard model, which is quantum chromodynamics, which is the colours and the stuff like that. But we've got this fundamental way to... This is almost like learning learning your vocabulary. So we have mesons and hadrons. Hadrons have got three, mesons have got two. Hadrons have got half integer, they're fermions, half integer isospin, and half integer spin. So spin is the angular momentum. Isospin is something more to do with the strong nuclear force. An isospin is this historic thing, and we're going to introduce the concept of other quarks. And the other quarks are unstable. That is, that they will go down to the lower energy quarks, up or down via the weak force. So a quark changing from an up to a down, or a down to a strange, is by the weak force, and the weak force is mediated by bosons. Vector bosons, W bosons, weak bosons, weak forces. So you can actually go from up to down quarks, but you have to actually invest in the energy and produce a whole series of other components. For us. It is quite interesting. So the sort of pedestrian stuff that you would get up on top of a 1940s mountain is, courtesy of cosmic rays, you get enough energy to produce some strange quarks. And once you produce strange quarks, you then have a whole series of things you can do. A whole series of mesons, there's something which has got me a bit confused. So if you only have up and down, you can make Pyquis mesons. If you have strange, I'm really going to get, because as I say it, I can't. A meson can be an up, it can be an up anti down, and that's a pi plus, or it can be an up anti up, and that can a pi naught that's got zero charge, or down anti down that's another pi particle. Now I'm just wondering whether that's three or four. I'll just have to. Then you've got the K mesons, which are made out of an up and down and that's right. It's three. I've got to really work this out. I've got to get it in my head. So a K meson is a a K meson is a is made out of a strange and an up or down. So you can get K naught. A strange meson has a third charge. So if you put a strange and an up together, you'll get a K1. Or if you have an anti-up and a strange, you'll get a K minus, because that'll be minus 1. Or you can get two varieties of K naught, the K and the anti-K naught. And it's a strange and a down together. That's plus a third, minus a third. Then you can get the eta mesons, which is a combination of these mesons together, and all up with strange and up and down quarks, picking one from either of the piles, you can make up 9 varieties. Now, the 9 varieties is sort of like, it's a bit head scratching. I can get 3, 4, 2. I've got 2 eta ones. Eta ones are more complex in that they've got a linear combination of a whole series of other quarks. A whole series of other mesons. And you sort of get really used to that because in quantum mechanics, you get hybrid sp3. Your introduction is very rarely what actually is in nature. So you get those 9 possible mesons, but across into the hadrons, you've got on your x-axis the 1 the isospin, which goes, isospin goes in units can either be half or minus a half. This is in sort of ground state, unexcited hadrons. Then you can, on the y-axis, and traditionally they always point this down for some reason. The y-axis, you introduce another quantum number called the strangeness. Now, essentially, in nuclear physics, they introduce a quantum number every time they want to do it. And so here's some of the quantum numbers for nucleons. There's the isospin, the strange number, the strange quantum number, the charm quantum number, the top quantum number, the bottom quantum number, and they can be, all those quantum numbers can be 0, plus or minus 1. It just becomes accounting. But they're still used. Now, this, the strange quantum number can be the following. It can be, you can have 1 strange particle or 2 strange particles. So you can have you can have an up, down, and a strange. I forgot what that's called. You got your deltas. It's actually quite simple. The Greek's alphabet. That's gone to me. That one has 0 charge, one strangeness and an ice spin of zero. So you can have, let's do it, you can have two ups and a strange, so that will have a charge of one, a nice spin of one, and a strangeness of one. So if it's hard for you to do, you probably have to go to the internet and look this up. Baryons, it produces ultimately a hexagon that is two minus one plus one on the x-axis. On the minus one, or which is actually one strangeness, you can have zero plus one or minus one, or the minus two, you can have which is two strange particles, an up or a down. They're equivalent to the neutron and proton beneath it, and you get all those particles to go across. And indeed, they have seen all these particles slightly different, the up and the down, and the strange all have slightly different mass requirements to produce them. And then what you can do is that you can then say, let my Isis spin vector actually go to two-thirds, where it can have projection to be a third or minus a third. Then you get the delta particles, and so on the unexcited state you have, let's put it seven states, I suppose, and on the excited states you have an extra three states possible. That's three ups, or three downs, or three strange, and three stranges is a strangeness quantum number of three. It actually really doesn't mean all that much. And the important thing here is that you can actually get into the actual nomenclature and actually put things up and actually see how these things are excited by themselves. So these actual little subatomic particles, even though they've got no spatial extent, they can have a symmetry excitation, a spin symmetry excitation and decay. And it's sort of interesting to see the things pull apart. There's sort of like two things. There's you can get a neutron or a proton in a nucleus, and it can have a spatial shape in that nucleus, and that spatial state can be a store of energy. That is, that spatial shape is slightly larger than nucleus, the mean of nucleus, and so it can actually be a strong force is pulling that into a small shape. So it can have a physical shape in our three dimensions, or the nucleus, a neutron or proton, can actually have energy inside itself. It can be an excited state within it, and in that case, it can be the delta. It can be you can have a neutron itself excited. So you have a proton, and it can obviously emit radiation, but it can do things. You can actually store it. You can get a proton and actually pump of energy and have the same particles, but in a different configuration. So it's sort of within it. And that obviously one, I suppose, could be in a nucleus if it ever lasts long enough to go through it. So it's in there. One of the things to understand is that the excited states of nucleons, or I suppose baryons, or even mesons. I suppose mesons, can they? Mesons have an excited... Mesons can have an excited state as well. That would be a bit complicated to think of. This is all within it. It's the... the difference is that the neutrons and protons are... Sorry, the atomic and nuclear excitation are spatial excitations within a field, which explains what's going on, whereas a nucleon is not a spatial, as far as we can tell, it's not a spatial reconfiguration. I suppose we would have a spatial, it's more a symmetry reconfiguration, similar to the way that a spin up, spin down electron changes from spin up to spin down, say in an MR machine. It actually physically doesn't change shape or does anything. It's a symmetry thing. So I've tried to explain that. I've been gone for an hour, and just it's a real hard mode to go through. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.